Good morning. It's Brian Mesrowski here on WBEN. Hope everyone is doing well out there on a Thursday morning. Hopefully you had a nice commute in. Looks like if you're in the North Towns, as per usual, no snow to have in your drive into work. You didn't have to worry about it, which is pretty nice. But for everyone else, watch out there. As you heard from Alan, still some tricky situations on the road this morning. Got a special guest joining me this morning and, delighted to have the conversation and welcome in Corinne Carey, who's the campaign director for Compassion and Choices. And we're talking about New York and assisted suicide in New York, end-of-life treatment, and how, if that is an idea that should be moving forward. Hey, Corinne, thanks so much for joining me this morning. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I want to just get started with your involvement here. Campaign Director, Compassion and Choices. What is behind you taking on this cause?
You know, I want to start out by saying at the outset for your guests and for you that we're not talking about suicide here. We're talking about people who are at the end of what many feel are a well-lived life, and it's a terminal disease that is taking their lives, and what they have to look forward to is certain death. And so these are people who are asking for help in making sure that the last few days or weeks of their lives aren't absolutely torturous. They're asking for help to bring about a dying process that is peaceful for them. So I wanted to make sure that we said that at the outset. But for me, I've spent my entire career in public interest law. I'm a lawyer, I'm a policy advocate, and I have been working at the intersection of public health and privacy for more than three decades. I take on tricky issues that balance individual rights and privacy and autonomy. And I've been thinking and working on these issues on an intellectual level for a very long time. And then about 10 years ago, my dad was diagnosed with lung cancer, and we quickly found out that it was stage four. The cancer spread to all parts of his body, including his brain. And mercifully, he died within 6 months from the diagnosis. He suffered, for sure, but he didn't suffer for long. And so I feel like that was a mercy for our family. But it got me and my mother and the rest of us thinking about what kind of care, what kind of interventions we would like for ourselves should we face the end of our lives like my dad did. And it just so turned out that at that point, about four states had already passed what is known as medical aid in dying laws that basically allow a person with a terminal illness to say to their doctor, look, if you can't cure me and you can't relieve my suffering, I would like the option to take medication prescribed for me by my doctor that will allow me to fall asleep and have a peaceful death. And it's as simple as that. Of course, the issues are not simple, but it was very clear that that was an issue that I needed to take on. So that's how I ended up where I am.
You know, at the start, and you made that distinction between something that a lot of people look at as assisted suicide versus what is known as medical aid in dying, for terminally ill patients, end-of-life care. How do you make that distinction? And I think for a lot of people who are listening to this, they might say, well, is there even a distinction to be made between the two? Aren't they really the same thing we're talking about?
Well, they're not at all. Medical aid in dying, as I said, is for people who are dying already. People who take their lives by suicide, this is a very complex and important public health issue. With proper intervention, people who are having suicidal thoughts, and I encourage anyone who may be to contact the National Suicide Awareness Number, but this is not that. This is about people who are dying, and it's an established medical practice where people consult two doctors. They surround themselves with family that they want to be with them in their final moments, and it is a peaceful death. When people die by suicide, they're more often than not absolutely alone. They've not consulted anyone. They haven't had access to the kind of care that they might need to live out a full rest of their lives. They die alone, and they often die in ways that are violent and traumatize their family and community members and emergency service personnel for a very long time. So the differences could not be more stark. And in fact, you know, allowing people who are struggling with being terminally ill to have this option to actually talk to their doctors about what they fear most. Some of those people may never ask for medical aid in dying. They may get the support that they need, whether that's palliative care, hospice, spiritual care, you know, other kinds of counseling, so that they would make a different decision. In some ways, this is a measure that would prevent someone from taking their lives in a violent way, traumatizing their family and community.
There's several places where this is legal right now, not in New York, but different countries nationwide, Canada notably. We'll get to that maybe more in a minute, but the Netherlands, New Zealand, Spain, Belgium, several others, parts of Australia too. This is becoming more popular. How does it work in places where this is legal? Does it look maybe vastly different from one place to another?
Well, you mentioned all of the places where medical aid in dying is legal in other countries, but it's much more important to focus on where it's legal here, because right now, 20% of Americans have access to this compassionate dying option. There are 10 states plus Washington, D.C. that allow for medical aid in dying, and each state in this country follows a very strict model of eligibility. One, in order to be eligible for medical aid in dying, needs to be terminally ill, and that means they have to have an illness that is incurable and irreversible. Two doctors have to confirm both the terminal illness and a prognosis of 6 months or less, and they both have to agree that the person has the mental capacity to make a medical decision of this import for themselves. The person also has to make a written request and a verbal request for the medication. And at the end of this process, during which the dying person alone is in charge, they need to be able to take that medication themselves. The laws in the United States are vastly different from the laws in the Netherlands and in Canada. And so I don't think that the comparison is apt. We've had more than a quarter of a century of evidence that shows that the laws in place here in the United States work as intended for a very small number of people who may suffer from just horrible end-of-life experiences without this option.
How does it stay that way, right? Like, that's the big question, because I think there are a lot of people who might have paid attention to this issue and agree with it on principle, and think that it is something that we should see in New York State, or, you know, wherever they may live, but then sees maybe how it has worked in other places and is a little wary of that. And, you know, I mentioned Canada before. You've mentioned the United States. In Canada, it maybe started as the same idea, right? A patient had to be in an advanced state of decline that couldn't be reversed. The death had to be reasonably foreseeable by a doctor, and you had to have some sort of serious illness or disability when their law was originally passed. But in recent years, those standards have really slipped away. Reasonably foreseeable, you know, no longer exists there. There is going to be an expansion of this program to people whose only illness is some sort of mental disorder coming up next year. 1 in 30 of all deaths in that country were by assisted suicide in 2021. And I think people look at that and say, wow, how did we go from what you just described to what we're seeing now there? And How is that prevented if we start down this path?
Well, I think there's an easy answer to that, and that is I'm going to go back to the fact that we have a quarter of a century of experience with these laws. Never in this country has there ever been a serious attempt to expand the law that started in Oregon in 1994 to encompass anything other than a terminally ill person with 6 months or less to live. The guard against that sort of mission creep, as it were, is you and me. It's organizations like Compassion and Choices. It's those of us on the ground doing end-of-life care work. This model works for the United States. It works for our set of values, and it has worked since 1994 without any serious attempt to change those strict eligibility guidelines. So looking over the border at Canada and how that, you know, how that concerns us, that might have been a concern 20 years ago, but it's not a concern for me now because we know in this country what works and what doesn't. You mentioned the statistics of how many people are using the law in Canada, and I'm no expert in the Canadian law, but I am in the U.S. law, and I will tell you that less than 1% of people in authorized states, in states that authorize medical aid in dying, actually use medical aid in dying. And more interesting than that is about 36% of the people who get the prescription never end up using it. They see it as kind of an insurance policy if things go wrong. And having that insurance policy allows people to live full lives at the end, to cross items off their bucket list, to take a last trip with their family or their friends, their loved ones, to undergo an experimental treatment because they know that if things go south and suffering starts to become unbearable, they have this option. But, you know, about 36% of the people don't actually end up taking it.
How did it switch? How did it, you know, kind of go down this other path up north of the border, and not what we see here in the U.S.?
I mean, all I can tell you is I'm not Canadian. I'm not there. I know that the legislature is reexamining that law in light of the statistics that you laid out. And I know that you're concerned about this because your listeners live literally right there on the border. But it's a different set of laws. It's a different system. It's a different medical system in Canada. I will tell you that one of the biggest motivators for my work is a Buffalo luminary named Dr. Robert Milch. And Dr. Milch was one of the first pioneers of hospice in this country. He started Hospice Buffalo with a colleague. It was one of the first 11 hospices in the whole country. And this was a time when the idea of hospice was just out there. You know, people didn't understand it. It wasn't accepted in medical practice. And he was a pioneer here. He joined our campaign, probably about 7 years ago. And what he said was he knew that if this had been an option while he was practicing, he would have been a better doctor. He would have been able to meet his patients where they were and give them what they needed by being able to prescribe this compassionate end-of-life care. He penned a letter on his deathbed. He died in 2021, and he penned a letter to lawmakers, and he said, inaction on this measure has become punitive because we've seen advocate after advocate with terminal illnesses in New York die over the past 8.5 years asking lawmakers for this option. So I think we need to look in our own backyards. We need to look at people like Dr. Milch, who had a vast amount of experience in the limits of hospice and palliative care. He knew that there were families that were getting the gold standard of palliative care and hospice because he started Hospice Buffalo, which, as you know, has served, I mean, it's not countless, mm-hmm. but thousands of families in the region. And he knew that having this law in place would give those doctors in hospice just one more tool in the toolbox if nothing else was alleviating suffering.
I don't know if this is getting too deep into it, rather than kind of focusing on the general issue, but should a doctor be able to bring this up to a patient? You know, in other words, if this were to be something to go forward in New York State, would you be in favor if the law was written in a way where this could not be brought up by a doctor, that it had to be initiated by the individual?
Well, the way the law is written, the way that the bill is written here in New York, is that it is the individual that proactively themselves brings up this request. It's not the doctor. But would I be in favor of tying a doctor's hands so that they can't talk to their patients about all of their end-of-life options? No, I wouldn't be in favor of something that would prohibit that. But as it stands, the law puts the onus on the patient to bring this up. There are laws that require doctors who are dealing with terminally ill individuals to talk to them about all of their end-of-life options. And it's important for people to understand the benefits of hospice and the benefits of palliative care. On the one hand, I don't believe we should be muzzling doctors in ways that maybe other states have done in other areas of the law. But I do believe that the law is right as written, in that it is the patient that initiates the request. It's not the suggestion of the doctor. And look, you know, doctors that I've worked with in end-of-life care, their interest is in preserving patient life. That is what they're, that's what they're in business for. But at some point, that becomes not possible any longer. And then you have to start looking at what options exist for a peaceful end. And hospice is an option. Palliative care is an option. And part of that is a number of other choices that someone would make about how they want the end of their life to look.
Where does this stand right now? You mentioned a bill. Obviously, it's not gone forward yet, but in Albany right now, where does the conversation lie? Is this something that might come up in the next year or so as, you know, something that has serious legs and momentum behind it to get passed?
Oh, this is a bill that could pass in 2024, and it should. We've been educating lawmakers. We've been traveling the state, holding educational forums and holding community discussions in church basements and social clubs all over the state. This bill is primed to move. Both sides have been heard. The questions have been asked and answered. And now it's really up to the leadership of the legislature to say, enough is enough. We've seen too much suffering. And we recognize that approving this measure, giving people a simple option to choose an end that is peaceful, that allows them to gather their family around them and say goodbye and die without the kind of trauma that we see people without this option dying with, this would truly be a gift to New York families. I can tell you about New Yorkers who have loved ones who live in states where this option is authorized, and what they describe is the kind of beautiful death that any of us would want for ourselves. New Yorkers deserve that, and lawmakers have the power to give this gift. It's really a gift of love, a gift of compassion, a gift of family to New Yorkers.
Well, Corinne, thank you so much for taking the time and joining me this morning.
Thank you for having me for this important discussion.
All right, Corinne Carey is the campaign director with Compassion and Choices, working on that bill in New York. What do you think? Should this be something that New Yorkers are allowed to do? Would you be interested in it? Do you have concerns? You can let me know after the break, 803-0930. Brian Mazeroski. I'll be back after the news with Lucas on WBEN. Good morning, Brian Mazeroski, back with you on WBEN. Still pretty clear up here in Amherst, looking nice. And sorry for those of you dealing with snow and rain this morning. Come live in the North Towns. It's beautiful here. I'm just saying. We're talking earlier this morning, and we'll take your calls now, 803-0930, if you have an opinion. And if you heard our last guest, Corinne was talking about medical aid in dying in New York. And she's been behind a push, basically looking to advance that bill in Albany, make it become law. New York is now not the law, but there are several states where this does happen. Her organization is Compassion and Choices, and they want basically new states to get on board and provide this medical aid in dying for, as she puts it, qualified terminally ill adults. And their organization mentions that by 2028, 50% of all Americans will live in some area where that is authorized. So that's their push. What do you think? 803-0930 to join me this morning. I do think it is a very complicated issue because it's one of these things. You know, yesterday we were talking a little bit about the 33 Project and how it was very interesting to me that so many people disapprove of it, but all for different reasons, right? Like the only agreement is that they don't like the idea, but that the idea itself, you look at it, right? It's basically putting a lid, slapping a parkway on top of a 3/4 of a mile stretch of the road that's already there. You know, you kind of went through, like, it's presented, and to a lot of people, they see it, $1 billion. You're just putting a roof on a road. Why? Like, it sounds stupid. But the whole thought process behind it, you know, I was going through it here with Joe. And as we were doing it, I'm like, well, try and find a flaw, right? Like you have people who are mad that the parkway was torn down and they want to see it restored. You have this road that's been here for well over a generation now that people are accustomed to using. People don't want to necessarily lose the 33 Expressway. You're trying to keep all people happy. Well, what do? Well, we can keep the road and then put this parkway on top of it, and it'll be expensive, but then you'll have the neighbors happy. They'll have a parkway. They're not looking at a highway anymore in this area, and people will be happy. They don't have to find a new way to work. Like, it kind of makes sense. Yet, at the end of the day, you come to this thing and present it to people, and you're like, oh, that's stupid. But the process was good. Like, all the thought behind it was good. And I'm not saying it's the exact same, but I do think that it is kind of a similar thing with what we're talking about today with this medical aid in dying. Because on the thought process, you listen to Corinne and you hear some of the stories of families who have kind of been through this process. Maybe families from other states who have gone through actual medical aid in dying before and speak very well of it. And it sounds like a good idea. It sounds like something that can be used infrequently to help the lives of a lot of people, right? But the end result to me is what I look at, and you know, I kept bringing up Canada to Corinne, and she, you know, said, well, I'm not concerned about Canada. I'm concerned about what's happening here in the United States. That's more of an apt comparison to her. And, you know, that might be true, but she said it as well, like, Toronto's a lot closer to us than Albany. So it's hard for me not to see what's happening just a stone's throw away across the water there and have that be my lasting impression of how this works in practice. And how do you prevent what's happening up there? The proponents of it say it's easy. It hasn't yet been done. It hasn't been taken to these extremes in the United States before. But think about what happened in Canada. So in Canada, as originally put forward, it sounds a lot like what they want to put forward here in New York. Doctors, or maybe a nurse or something, would carry this out only to patients who met certain criteria, which was you had to have a serious illness or disability. You had to be in an advanced state of decline that could not be reversed. You had to experience unbearable physical or mental suffering and had to be at a point where natural death had become reasonably foreseeable. You know, that a terminal illness, basically, in other words, where a doctor could look at a patient and say, okay, like we kind of know what is, well, not kind of, we do know what is going to happen here, reasonably foreseeable. And I think that is the kind of thing that a lot of people, if you put that in front of a, you know, everybody across the state of New York, I think a lot of people would look at that and say, you know what, I, even if it's not something you would ever consider for yourself, not something you would really think about or want for a family member, you could see that being a reasonable thing to put in place. And when that happened back in 2016, north of the border, everyone was reassured that this is how it's going to stay, right? You had Justin Trudeau said, well, it's not going to happen where we're going to endanger the lives of anyone who's mentally vulnerable or anyone who's not near death, right? But then you fast forward just 5 years after they passed the initial law, the criteria that natural death must be reasonably foreseeable was eliminated from their law. So it no longer had to be a terminal illness. It no longer had to be a foregone conclusion that whatever you were suffering from was leading to the end of your life. And so in response, in 2021, 1 in 30 of all Canadian deaths were by assisted suicide. I mean, think of that number. I mean, that it seems unbelievable. To Corinne's point, who joined us earlier this morning, she's lobbying for this law to happen in New York. Now, not the way it is in Canada, but under the original spirit of the law, I guess you would say. She said, all across the United States, that number is very low. In fact, 30% of people who are even approved for it don't even go through with it at the end. And laws in the United States have been on the books some as far away as almost 30 years now, since the early to mid-90s. And we haven't seen this radical expansion of the law the same way we have up north. So that's why she's saying we shouldn't be focusing on Canada, but it's hard not to. So now, next year, north of the border in Canada, they're moving to extend eligibility for medical aid in dying to people whose only illness is a mental disorder. And remember, back in 2016, the fear was that it would endanger those who are psychologically vulnerable. The Prime Minister said that's just not something that ends up happening. By next year, if your only illness is a mental disorder, you could be approved for exactly this. And there's a set of recommendations. Now, this isn't going to be the law, but recommendations put forth by this group, A Dying with Dignity in Canada, which is the activist group that was initially behind this push. They want to expand eligibility to include what they call mature minors, which would be defined as at least 12 years old and, this is their quote, capable of making decisions with respect to their health. I don't know about you. I don't really know a 12-year-old who's informed enough to make almost any decision, much less this one, about their own health. But that is where, now again, that is just their new push. But think about how that's expanded from a terminal illness to an advanced state of decline that couldn't be reversed, where death is reasonably foreseeable in the near-term future of somebody experiencing unbearable suffering, to now expanding to where, well, we don't necessarily need this to lead to death, and it could be somebody as young as 12, possibly, capable of making that decision. And my fear is, while I listen to the people who advocate for this law to pass in New York State, my heart goes out to their families, my heart goes out to people who are dealing with this in a very real way right now, I can't help but look at what happened a stone's throw away and worry about that same thing happening right here. There was a story in the Associated Press not that long ago. A 61-year-old man, Alan Nichols, submitted a request for medical aid in dying. And despite concerns raised by his family and a nurse practitioner, ended up getting it and was killed. His application listed only one health condition as the reason for his request to die: hearing loss. And that we have gotten to that point so close to here, right, in a country that we think of as being fairly similar, aside from serving milk in a bag and having two languages on their stop signs, right? It's fairly similar to us here in the U.S. For that to be hearing loss, and a doctor can say, okay, come on in, that's good enough for me. Like, that is scary enough for me to say, I don't know if I would want this in any respect here in New York State. And that's only the reason that I'm thinking of it. 803-0930, if you have an opinion on this, and maybe it's something you've experienced or thought about because of a personal experience, or maybe just you're kind of looking at the situation going on. Should this be allowed in New York State? The push is going to be made at the beginning of next year for this to, you know, whether it's included in the budgets where a lot of these policy programs go through, or some other point during the next session. This is going to be a major push in New York. Should it be? Let me know about it. 803-0930. I just think that once you, I'm not sure how you can, and again, as it's originally perceived, it is understandable. But you look at the ways it's expanded in other countries. Once you start to make decisions about life or death of somebody else, you know, if you're a doctor in this case, approving or denying an application, and you're basing it only on the quality of their life. You know, there's a lot of talk in Canada about how just simply being homeless, you know, homeless without friends, you know, some of these people in despair, instead of getting any sort of help, it's just now, well, you could apply to die. I mean, that's just crazy to me. I mean, are you not suggesting, right? Are you not suggesting the exact opposite of basically the principal value that you're trying to build your whole society on is that everybody is created equal? I mean, you are suggesting some lives can be more readily disposed than others. All lives aren't equal by doing this. And that's the way I kind of look at it. 803-0930. We'll go to the phones, go to the text board here. A lot of you people are chiming in with this. Someone saying it should only be for terminally ill patients, such as those with stage 4 cancer. If there is a way to ensure that that is it and it would not expand anymore, I think I would be right with you. I want to know, you know, maybe we should get a Canadian law expert in here to talk a little bit about how this went down this slope. How is it easier in some countries than others? You know, I would like the entire process to start over again if somebody came with the idea that, oh, let's remove reasonably foreseeable, you know, terminally ill from our list of criteria on when we would do this. You know, that should have to go through the whole process again. Is there something in Canada where it's like, can we tack this on or scrub it more easily from the law? Because how does that happen? So I agree with the person who texted in. That is kind of where I sit on this. I understand the argument of bodily autonomy, right? You know, I should be able to. I see a lot of those comments on the text board. You know, if somebody wants to die, it's nobody's business but their own. You know, it's my choice when to go. And I think that has to have its limits, right? Like, that has to have its limits in a reasonable society. And if it doesn't, I mean, where do we land? And if it doesn't, and you're lowering the age to, you know, as this group in Canada is recommending, 12 years old. The idea that there's 12-year-olds who are capable of making decisions like this, I mean, it's scary to think that people think that way. I get the idea of bodily autonomy. But I think in a society like we live in, you also have to kind of put it, you have to put yourself and look at yourself in the terms of your value to other people. And your value just as a whole. And you might think that somebody who's in despair in one of these states that doesn't exist, but it does. You know, how can I work to be better for everybody else? And just kind of eliminating that, it's not something that I think I would be comfortable with. Not something that I think a lot of people should be comfortable with. And, you know, again, that's just you can say it's going to work. We're in America. It'll work like how it has in the United States for many years. But again, we're a whole lot closer to Toronto than we are to Albany. So I only have one way of looking at it. We got Joe Beamer is coming in. What's going on, Joe? You want to come in here? What's happening in the next? Joe Beamer is going to be in for David Bellavia. Coming up just after the news. What do you got planned, Joe?
Well, Brian, you know, when tipping is in the news, you know I like to talk about tipping. DoorDash is now telling customers, hey, you don't leave a tip, your food might be cold and late. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, a different spin, because there are some apps out there, Instacart's one of them, where you can leave a tip, but if your service stinks, you can deduct from that tip, right? So it's not like, oh, I paid already and then got bad service. Well, yeah, you tipped, and then you got bad service. Now you can take that tip away. Talk a little bit about that. Amusement parks, the one entertainment sector that has not risen since the pandemic. We'll talk about that. That's in the news.
It's 30 degrees out. I wonder why.
But it's in the news because Six Flags and Cedar Fair have merged to form Six Flags.
Cedar Fair?
Cedar Fair, they own Cedar Point and a few Midwest.
Yeah, I was going to say, I heard of Cedar Point, but
owned by Cedar Fair.
Okay.
So they're merging to form Six Flags. We'll talk a little bit about that. And I'm doing an hour on the election every day I'm in. Today, we're going to talk about the proposals. There are proposals in Amherst. There are proposals in North Tonawanda. We'll talk about those as well on the show. That and so much more.
You know, we talked about that tipping thing. I always... you know, you should be expected to tip a delivery driver, which is why I never order delivery.
Well, this has always been my thing.
Yeah.
If you can't tip, go pick it up.
Yeah.
I always pick up.
I always pick up because I don't feel like spending double the price.
Yeah.
For by the time you add in the inflated price you see online or when you order, the service charge that the app charges you or whatever, then what you have to pay.
You are paying double.
For a tip, you're easily paying double. So I just don't do it.
I am glad that people do it because I like to do it. I like to get the money. But
were you like the other guy that we heard of who peed in the Chick-fil-A cup and accidentally handed it because he just doesn't stop anywhere on the roads?
I am not like that. No, I go use the bathrooms.
All right, it's good to know.
Yeah, I use the bathrooms when I'm shopping, when I've gone to the bathroom, I've washed my hands. I am not, no going to the bathrooms happening in the car. I've told you the story. I am a huge no-no about going to the bathroom in the car. I hate to stop.
What a brave stance to take.
I told you the story growing up. growing up, there was this family we would travel with, and they didn't like to stop. Now, I don't like to stop either, but if you have to go to the bathroom, we're going to stop. And they would bring a jar, and that's what you would go to the bathroom in. And I'm sorry, I don't care how much of a hurry I'm in, there will never be a pee jar in my car.
There's always the side of the road.
Yes.
There's always the
tire needs
road.
A check.
That's right. Well, you got that, and I'm sure much more coming in. Joe is in for David, coming up after the news with Lucas on WBEN.